Good morning, everybody. We're a little late getting started this morning, so may I ask you to take your seats. And welcome to the Priority of Distributive Justice panel. This is the first panel to address Rod's private law scholarship, although Rod would likely contest the silo between the public and the private implied by the label private law. Indeed, one of his very often repeated pieces of advice to new scholars, new faculty members, has been that those whose work is primarily engaged with public law should teach at least one private law course. The texts selected for our panel, consultation with Rod, are all drawn from Rod's work in relation to the law of security on property. It's not a surprising choice. Among private law subjects, this area most directly engages issues of distributive justice. It's, after all, a contract to grant security is essentially a contract between A and B that C shall get nothing, with C representing the collectivity of other creditors who would otherwise have a claim to the patrimony of an insolvent debtor. So the question of distributive justice raised by secure transactions law is to what extent we should give full force to private party autonomy, notwithstanding this evident distributional effect on third parties. Before turning to how Rod addresses and resolves the distributive question directly, I want to say a few more general words about the five texts assigned for this panel, and their common elements, and the background to them. As Rod notes in his article on Article 9, Norm Entrepreneurship, the last 60 years or so have seen attention paid to the reform and so-called modernization of secured transactions law, first at the national level, and in the last several decades since the Washington Consensus, to which Harry Arthurs referred, at the transnational and global level. Efficient secured transactions regimes are seen to be a key piece of the needs of the global economy, the need to facilitate trade across borders. And Article 9, the U.S., United States secured transactions regime, and derivatives of Article 9 are seen as the model regime for transnational and global law. Now, throughout his career, Rod has been front and center in this in reform initiatives here in Quebec, and his work with the Civil Code Revision Office that eventually led to the new regime of security in the Civil Code of 1994, in crafting abroad Ukraine's 2004 charge law, and as a member of the Canadian delegation to the Incitral Working Group that produced the Legislative Guide to Secure Transactions of 2008, which Rod, along with Richard Cohen, who's here with us today, principally authored. So Rod's texts are all very much rooted in practical wisdom and are a reflection of, again, what Harry Arthurs emphasized yesterday, Rod's commitment to phronesis, practical wisdom, judgment informed by experience. Thematically, and you will not be surprised by this in light of yesterday's themes, all four texts, or four of the texts, I shall come to the fifth in a moment, seek to inculcate an informed skepticism to single models, approaches, Article 9 or otherwise, to secure transactions form. Methodologically, Rod accomplishes his goal by exposing the diversity of legal, legal technology, legal architectural, extra-legal factors, social, political, institutional, historical, accidental, that explain why single model answers are unattainable, undesirable, if effective reform is the goal, and why the responses of different states will vary not just in space but also in time. Stylistically, the Rod's texts reflect his signature use of metaphor and allegory to communicate his thesis. For example, in three metaphors of abnormal migration in the international context, he frames his analysis using the metaphors of harmonization, Quebec is the example, transplantation, the Ukraine charge law, as the example, and viral propagation, the UNCTRL's legislative guide, and then turns to a secondary set of metaphors drawn from music, horticultural and botany, and genetics to explain and make his case for why each of these models of norm migration have their defects and inevitably result in certain compromises. From a theoretical point of view, the texts, as one might expect, reflect Rod's commitment to a pluralistic approach. And this, the final footnote in one of the texts makes this explicitly. He points out that the most commercial law reform takes its cue from a metaphysical, philosophical approach of the type reflected, for example, in the work of Rawls, Theory of Justice. His approach, he points out, not surprisingly, prefers instead differentiated models of distributive justice of the type suggested by Walzner and John Elster. Rod's skepticism towards single model approaches is inevitably tempered. He is not a believer in mindless pluralism. He sees room for harmonization at a high level. And this takes us to the fifth text, which is core objectives of a secure transactions law, and returns us to the question of distributive justice. Core objectives of a secure transactions law is not a published text. It is referred to in a number of the other articles, but it was in fact prepared for the first expert working group on secure transactions hosted by UNCTRL, and it was one of two competing texts that were put before the working group. One of those texts referred to, and it was the one that ended up becoming principle one of the legislative guide, referred to the design, the object or the paramount principle being to design an efficient and effective secure transactions law that would promote low-cost credit by enhancing the availability of secured credit. Now let's compare that with Rod's core first principle. Coherence with public policy and legal tradition. Corollaries of that proposition, a regime of security on property is an adjunct to the regime of debtor-creditor relationships and should reflect a balance between the legitimate public policy goals of states and the principle of freedom of contract. Another corollary of that principle, a regime of freedom of contract, is a political choice that states make and must be well integrated into the overall distributional logic of debtor-creditor relationships. Finally, a regime of security on property is necessarily wealth redistributing. Consequently, states should be entitled to establish the conditions under which different forms of wealth transfer occur. So back to then the concrete question of distributional justice that Rod's first principle is designed to bring to the forefront and why it's important today. Historically, distributive justice considerations and secure transactions law were in the background. As long as the only objects of security were the mortgage on Blackacre or the possessory pledge in favor of a pawnbroker, there were other assets inevitably available to satisfy the claims of unsecured creditors. The Article 9 model permits all assets financing, that is to say, it is now possible for a grantor to give security on the entirety of its patrimony, on the entirety of its estate. And that all-encompassing idea of security runs directly in conflict with the basic principle of insolvency law that the assets of a debtor are subject to the equal claims of all creditors, or as it's put in the civil code, that the assets of a debtor are the common pledge of his creditors. As Rod points out in a number of the texts, once you permit the entire patrimony of a person to be made the object of security, the law of secure transactions threatens to swallow the entirety of insolvency law and debtor-creditor law. That debate, whether this should be permitted, has occupied the academic literature over several decades now. The argument put forward by the law and economic scholars is that overall social welfare is enhanced by the grant of security, and that other creditors who choose not to take security can adjust to the added risk of their loss of priority by charging a higher interest rate or so forth. That argument, of course, does not take account of the fact that many creditors are involuntary creditors, a victim of a tort, or they're not capable of adjustment, such as the state, also, in a sense, an involuntary creditor, or employees who can hardly be expected to ask for security on the assets of the employer as a condition of employment. So where does Rod come down in that debate? He's quite clear in the core objectives, and it's the purpose of the core objectives, that he sees the distributive justice issue as not being fully answerable by the law and economics, that there are other public policy choices that states should be entitled to make and should be able to effectuate in providing, in some form, some protection, some cushion of assets, some special privileges for involuntary and non-adjusting creditors. But then he has to work out how to reconcile his instinctive rejection of the primacy of private bargains over public choices with his pluralist instincts. We can't give a single answer to the distributive justice question. His solution is structural, and it is part of those core objectives that he wanted to put forward. The structural solution is to conceive of secured transactions reform as a subset of debtor-creditor law, and therefore required to take into account the entirety of that field, so judgment execution law, insolvency law, debtor-creditor law, and thereby to ensure that the interests of unsecured creditors, of employees, of involuntary creditors, of judgment creditors, and so forth, that their voices are heard in the reform exercise. If one instead begins from the predicate that secured transactions law is to be privileged in the sense of private contract secured transactions law, then the voices of the third parties who are affected by the security bargain are not even brought in to the exercise. The end of the day, I think, despite the manner in which the core principles of the legislative guide were articulated, I think Rod's concerns ended up being reflected in the text that was produced. The one recommendation of the guide that deals with the distributive justice issue concerns the question of whether certain classes of unsecured creditors should be receive a special statutory preference against primary secured creditors. And the guide takes a neutral position on the issue, as opposed to there were some states that would have preferred that the guide say, because it will chill access to consensual secured creditors, states should not have allowed for any statutory preferences. At the end of the day, they took a neutral issue, and I think Rod's voice was very much responsible for that conclusion. I'll conclude with addressing the two issues that the balance of the panel will be also addressing, and that is how is Rod's work likely to affect the future of research in the field of secure transactions and his influence on my own work. And I'll do them in reverse order. Rod's scholarship also addresses distributive justice issues, not just between secured creditors and unsecured creditors, but within the ranks of secured creditors. And he points out that what we are seeing happening in the Article 9 and derivative model, it's also reflected in the legislative guide, is an increased an increase in the number of non-temporal priority rules among classes of secured creditors, in particular in relation, and this is something in the last 10 years, in relation to cases where the collateral that's encumbered consists of financial collateral, securities in securities accounts, money deposited in bank accounts. The non-temporal priority rules are emerging to create a super privileged class of secured creditors, financial institution, in the interest of facilitating the financial industry and the financial markets. So these creditors, in effect, those who are financing the financial economy, are now coming ahead of creditors, secured creditors, who are financing the real economy. So we've moved beyond distributional justice issues as between the great mass of small trade creditors and other unsecured creditors, creating a hierarchy where the financial economy trumps the real economy, as I said. So I think there are two aspects of that. It's important for us, for the public policy implications of that particular choice as between who wins and who loses in terms of financing, to be brought to the fore. That's an important aspect of the research. It also puts into question, and Rod points this out, whether there really is a single unified model anymore, even within the Article 9 jurisdiction of secure transactions reform. That model was predicated on a publicity-based secure transactions regime with temporal rules of priority among secured creditors. It's increasingly becoming disaggregated into a regime that is predicated on the type of collateral and the type of financier. As for Rod's influence on my work, in one of his pieces, Transnational Secure Transactions Law, Rod's first footnote says that he'd like to thank his colleague, Catherine Walsh, for two decades of rich exchange about secure transactions regimes. I think thanks are all due from me to you for the two decades now approaching a quarter of a century of rich exchange. Thank you, my friend. next two speakers are coming in to us virtually, one live, all the way from Perth, Australia, and second in a pre-taped video from Michael Bridge. So, Ralph, you've been standing by, and it's, 9:30 at night in Perth? We shouldn't keep you up anymore.
No, it's 10:30.
10:30.
10:30.
Worse.
Thank you, Kathy. I take it from your last remark that Rod is in the audience somewhere, and he will, of course, know that this year we celebrate the 40th anniversary of our professional lives together. And I can only applaud McGill for this terrific idea as a means of celebrating his work and engaging with it in what I would have to assume is a critical way. I have to add that I haven't had the benefit of seeing the prior proceedings. I can only plead that I was drinking excellent wine in Margaret River to the south of Perth. But I was thinking of Rod as I was doing that. Can I address the two topics that Kathy raised in the same order with which she dealt with them, or at least it's, I think it's the same order. The first, what is the impact of this set of texts on your own work? And the second is, what implications do they have for future research, which I interpreted as both my own and the research of others. As to impact, my immediate reaction as a judge now of some 10 years is that impact was nil, particularly as I've done very little work as a judge in the area of secured transactions law. As far as I can tell, the federal court, I'm a judge of the state Supreme Court, the federal court has captured all the work on the new Federal Personal Property Securities Act, much to my annoyance and that of a number of my colleagues. But as I began to think some more about those texts, none of which I was previously familiar with, it became apparent that they embodied ideas of Rod in an area of private law, law of secured transactions, which we have a shared interest in. And they were ideas which, although in a different form, I've seen at play since I met him in 1974 when we were both graduate students at the University of Toronto. I want to talk about three ideas that I recognized in the text. Only one of these ideas appears in one of the texts in so many words, and there is a door prize for those who can find it. It's not altogether easy to find in the text. But what I wanted to celebrate in part, I think, is not simply the ideas, but Rod's, or some of Rod's, turns of phrase, which I think are wonderful. Not least his description of much case comment scholarship as the work of unreconstructed court groupies, which is a turn of phrase that I immediately, of course, put to one side. Can I then just talk briefly about those three ideas and their impact on my work? And I can provide citations if members of the audience are really, really interested. The first idea is what working with rules looks like if you take both rules and their context seriously. And that's obviously of great importance in understanding the jurisdiction's law of secured transactions, as Kathy has indicated. But I realized as I thought some more about it that that fairly straightforward idea, a simple idea, has had resonance and influence with me over my entire legal career, since repeated exchanges with Rod enabled me to think about the idea carefully. The idea's resonance with me now, and here I perhaps make the point that Kathy made a moment ago about how important it was for public lawyers to teach private law, and of course vice versa, is that presently I'm working almost entirely in criminal law matters. And it seems to me that Rod's idea, take rules and their context seriously, has enabled me to see and occasionally have jousts with legal counsel over the difficulties, not only in using precedents from other states with facially similar criminal law, but even more interestingly, the difficulties in using precedents from one's own state when our criminal code, under the influence of the law and order movement particularly, and local sentencing regimes are modified legislatively and restated judicially on an annual basis. The second idea is about the inevitability of forms as contingent, malleable, but surprisingly stable in any given jurisdiction. That, of course, is of considerable importance to Rod in his secure transaction scholarship, as these five texts illustrate. For me, that idea, which I'm familiar with from discussions that go back to 1974 that I've had with Rod, has been of great use to me in the work I've done on constructive trusts, particularly in reflecting on the importance attached by courts in this country to constructive trusts and what exactly they are in the law of affective relationships in this country, particularly de facto relationships. The third idea is not so much an idea, perhaps, as a line. It was a line that Rod and I think it was a joint enterprise, Rod can correct me, came up with at an early 1980s conference at McGill in the Meredith Memorial Lecture Series on takeover bids, another area of private law with important distributive, indeed literally distributive implications. The idea is that law reform, good law reform, is not so much, although it can be, the generator of better legal answers, but as a generator of better legal questions. And it's an idea that I've recycled constantly ever since. But the idea, as I've drawn upon it in my own work as a judge, has been, I think, in my descriptions, in my judgments of the legal principles, how I describe them, the legal principles I've discerned in the authorities cited to me, to the extent I find those authorities and the principles I derive helpful in resolving the issues that I have to resolve. And the other aspect of it is that the idea, law reform as generator of questions, is also central to my developing conception of the common law tradition, where Pat Glynn's wonderful book got some of the inquiry started. As to implications for future research, again, I have an immediate answer. It's that it will affect my life after I retire as a judge and can actually do legal research, or at least academic legal research. But that's because, of course, research as a judge is what the next listing demands. But what I can say, as I thought about it some more, is and particularly thought about the larger body of Rod's work in which these texts and his thoughts about secure transactions law are embedded, is, as closely as I can describe it, the remarkable possibilities for transformative legal research, which is a turn of phrase I would never use in a judgment. But for me, perhaps it comes out more clearly, not so much in his secure transactions work as in his work in administrative law, where that work has had a great impact on how I approach sentencing decisions. Put simply, and beyond the terms of distributive justice, Rod's work as a whole shows how thinking about law hard enough to make your head hurt is good for you and might be good for others. And that is to make a statement, I think, about more than my own future research, of a kind that Arthur Allen Leff made much more elegantly, although not to the same effect by any means, in a Yale Law Journal issue on legal research at a conference that Rod and Mindy Pascal Mead and I all went down to Yale to watch and found enormously satisfying. My hope, concluding these brief remarks, is that Rod will find some satisfaction or at least amusement in the statement I just made of a simplifying and qualified kind of appreciation of his work, a statement that borrows a favourite turn of phrase of his. And Rod has given us some wonderful turns of phrase as only the best law teachers in any language can give us. Thank you. I can see you, Kathy. I think.
Good morning to you from Singapore.
Okay, so is Ralph still online?
Yeah, but he can leave whenever he wants.
Ralph, you're permitted to go to bed now if you wish, or stay with us and watch your virtual companion Michael Bridge deliver his presentation, or get up early in the morning and watch the rest of it. But we're going to turn to Michael now, who's coming in from Singapore.
Okay. Is he appearing live?
No, it's pre-recorded.
Good.
He had the jump on you.
I will dine out on the fact that he was not live.
I'll tell him that.
Right.
Here we go. Oh, okay, that didn't work.
Good morning to you from Singapore. I'm recording this message in the afternoon, but I'm conscious of you. It's the morning. There is, of course, a 13-hour time difference between Singapore and Montreal. But nevertheless, by virtue of this video recording, we may be able to bridge that time gap. We can't, however, do anything about the thermal gap. It's 40 degrees warmer here than it is in Montreal. Without more ado, let me turn to my theme for today, which is the law of secured transactions. As everybody knows, this has close proximity to the theme of distributive justice, which is so dear to Rod MacDonald's heart. The themes I want to dwell upon particularly today are two. The first is the modernization of personal property security law. The second is what we might call fairness, which perhaps is but distributive justice under another name. And I'm conscious all the while of the fact that my own introduction to Lon Fuller's work on distributive justice came at the behest of Rod. Taking now modernization as the first of my two themes, it's well known, I think, to everybody here, that there has been an historical antipathy to non-possessory security. It was present certainly in the common law, and it dates clearly and demonstrably from the 16th century, but I think it's fair to say that that hostility disappeared from common law systems and thinking rather more quickly than it did from the civil law. The civil law was driven to treat the non-possessory pledge as a kind of deemed possessory device by fictitious means. And I think that evidences to a degree a certain uneasiness with non-possessory security that pertains even to this day. My next point concerns the conviction that easy access to secured credit is beneficial to the development of commerce and thus to all concerned. And we come now to the historic debate between trade creditors and banks. The bank says, if we didn't finance the business, then you wouldn't have access to this particular customer. And the trade creditor might say that our supply of credit to the customer is what keeps the business going and therefore able to pay down the debt that you have advanced to the trade participant. Well, I suppose I take the view that ultimately easy secured credit does serve a critical purpose. That doesn't mean that the bank should necessarily always and fully prevail. Article 9 cannot be disregarded, of course, in any account given to modernisation. And one can say that it resolves the debate or the discussion in terms of notions of transparency and rationality. Transparency in the sense that secured credit, if not seen to be a matter of possession, should nevertheless be a matter of public record. Rationality in terms of the obliteration of outmoded legalistic distinctions, notably that between retention of title and security, properly so called in the form of a charge or a similar type of security device. Now, the Article 9 resolution of the matter is very much, as we all know, in terms of functionalism. If something looks like security, well, then it is security. Don't tell me what it's called, tell me what it does. But there is a certain reductive aspect to this, so that everything, if seen through that particular lens, can ultimately be seen to be a matter of security, and it therefore becomes hard to know where to draw the line between that which should be regulated as security and that which ought not to be. You might say that functionalism, if carried to an excessive degree, imparts a type of new religiosity. And I've certainly seen in the ranks of Article 9 advocates some degree of firm conviction that one must subscribe to the ipsissima verba of Article 9 in whatever manifestation it currently is in order to be a true advocate of modernized secure credit. I don't necessarily agree with that. And in fact, I note the growing conviction that a differentiation can properly be drawn between title-based schemes and security in the narrow sense, and yet still serve the cause of transparency and rationality. And this is evident in instruments such as the Cape Town Convention and also the UN Legislative Guide on Secured Transactions, and I think we can thank Rod MacDonald perhaps more than most people, perhaps more than anybody, for his firm view and belief that this distinction can still be retained within a modernised personal property security regime. Article 9 thinking nevertheless retains its utility within bounds, especially in cross-border initiatives, because it is a very powerful type of device, an intellectual device, for cutting through domestic historical dogma and opening up the field for international collaboration. Having said all of that, one has to note that developments in financial markets pose a very significant threat to transparency. I have in mind, from the perspective of a European, the financial collateral arrangements regulations and the various exemptions from filing and the like that are given in the case where collateral is under the control of the secured creditor. I have to say that I find it rather difficult myself to see control as a form of true transparency or publicity. I tend to see it very much as an exemption, but that is not something that can comfortably be said to an Article 9 zealot. So turning from modernisation to fairness, let me start with the classic English case law approach, which regards security and reservation of title as a simple matter of contract. In fact, the whole law of English secured transactions is an extension of the notion of contract. Equity sees that as done which ought to be done. A contract to give security is as good as security. And consequently, we see, this is still present in English law, freedom of contract as being the paramount consideration in the creation of security, which involves more or less the denial of any role for public policy and the belief that unsecured creditors can be put on one side, notwithstanding the pari passu rule of distribution, so that secured creditor and debtor can work out their arrangements without
any need to concern themselves with that third-party constituency. And of course, what this amounts to in a bilateral world of case law and litigation is a disregard of distributive justice considerations. How then do we achieve fairness? Well, broadly, by legislative means. You might say fairness can arise by accident if you make it difficult to obtain secured credit by putting up roadblocks and chicanes and limiting particular types of security device to particular cases. Now that is not, I think, a particularly satisfactory way of proceeding. An alternative approach, and this is the approach adopted in England, is to make it easy to take security, but then to top-slice the security. So legislative changes in England have created out of floating charge assets a fund in favour of unsecured creditors. And moreover, the very powerful instrument of administrative receivership has been converted by and large into out-of-court administration, and a directive imposed upon administrators prior to distributing to secured creditors to take into account the interests of both secured and unsecured creditors. Now that to me is a little bit like comparing apples and oranges, and I'm not sure that outcomes are particularly different. It could be said that this kind of approach is not a great deal more than a box-ticking exercise. And when we come to assessing the degree of fairness thus imparted into the system, then we have to wonder how we quantify the necessary degree of fairness. Can we do it in raw percentage terms, as a legislative instrument might direct, or is the achievement of distributive justice something that is altogether more nuanced and to be assessed only on a case-by-case basis? Well, it's very hard to measure that kind of judicial discretion with legislative lawmaking. It's well known that many years ago, the Crowther Committee in England thought that the needs of secured, or rather unsecured creditors could be satisfied by putting aside a 10% margin. And how was that achieved? Was it by virtue of some profound discussion? Well, not really. It was a back-of-the-envelope calculation, as Roy Good himself has recounted on numerous occasions. So, I certainly support the need for distributive justice, but I'm not quite sure how we get there and whether we have the right instruments to achieve it. Well, that takes me, I guess, to the final part of this short presentation, and we can call this a personal note. I spent nearly 10 very happy years at McGill. I would regard those years as the most productive and contented of my academic life, and that was due very largely to the environment and to my colleagues there. And I have to say that I found the role of Rod a particular stimulant in my enjoyment of my time at McGill. He was both provocative and stimulating, and we had discussions where we did not agree. In particular, I do not favour broad discretionary standards of good faith. I'm sure that Rod does not agree with me on that, so there was give and take. I found an interest in personal property law, accidentally, as a result of changes to the curriculum, I think, initiated or carried through by Rod at a time when I was active at McGill, and that has stood me in very good stead. I'm very sorry that I'm not present on the occasion of this symposium, and I wish all concerned my best wishes for the future. I'm very sorry, Rob, that I can't be there. I hope that you draw a great deal of enjoyment and sustenance from this symposium held in your honour. Thank you.
Well, of course, Rod's work in the private law area, it was not confined to secure transactions law, and the balance of our panelists will depart from that field and address the implications of his work in other areas, which may come as a relief to many of you present in the audience today. John McCamus on Rod and the Law of Restitution.
Maybe.
Let me begin by saying it's a wonderful honor and privilege to participate in this tribute to the legal imagination and legal scholarship of Rod MacDonald. Rod's one of the world's most prolific and most profound legal scholars. He's an adornment to the Canadian Legal Academy and to the Faculty of Law at McGill in particular. I must begin with a caveat, indeed a confession of near fraud. When I was invited to participate by Richard Janda, I was advised of the title of this panel and immediately had misgivings. I was told it would focus on Rod's personal property security law scholarship. My own connection with these fields is very glancing and ancient. Nonetheless, I could not resist. I said yes immediately, so pleased to be able to join in this tribute to Rod's magnificent career and work. When the materials arrived, my misgivings were multiplied quite considerably. Each of the papers deals with the subject of global reform of personal property security law at great length. Rod tends to write at great length. I started one paper. He began by saying, "This short essay is on something," and I thought, "Oh, wonderful! This is." I won't blow a day, I'll just blow an evening. And sure enough, it was 40 pages long. In any event, I delved into the papers. I could not resist, and I consumed them and enjoyed them thoroughly. In the short time I have, I'm just going to identify a few features of Rod's work that impressed me most and draw a couple of lessons from it and try to apply those lessons to my own work, all of this done with hopefully appropriate brevity. First of all, Rod's work has tremendous range. I won't go on about that. It's illustrated in the various topics covered in the symposium. It's an unbelievably broad range. Most of us, like myself, focus narrowly on one or two aspects of the law, devote our lives to it. Rod seems to cover it all. And this enormous coverage is not at all achieved at the price of superficiality or lack of depth. In the papers that we were asked to read for this panel, they display enormous mastery of the great detail of the law of personal property security and an ability to draw on a very rich theoretical literature. I look at Rod's footnotes and I see all the books that I wish I'd read being referred to and lessons drawn from them. It's most impressive. Rod has a remarkable ability to articulate and identify the foundational ideas at play in any subject, and he does that in these papers on personal property security. Kathy's already mentioned his set of core ideas that he presented to UNCITRAL. The papers chronicle Rod's work in law reform in the personal property security field. But Rod, of course, has a deep commitment to law reform in a more general way and has been very active in law reform activities both institutionally with his brilliant tour as president of the Law Commission of Canada and, of course, intellectually as well. He's contributed much to the literature of law reform, including these papers. Kathy has mentioned his colorful use of language and metaphor, and it is in abundant evidence in these papers. Who else but Rod would think of calling people who advocate particular models of law reform as norm entrepreneurs? I'd never heard the expression before. As in Article 9, norm entrepreneurs. Those are American people that Rod eventually comes not to like so much. In one of his papers, Rod asks the question whether UNCITRAL, having already developed a legislative guide setting out in general terms what new personal property security legislation might look like, he asked whether or not they should follow that by crafting a model law that could be enacted across various jurisdictions. Rod's answer to this question in the paper is no, that's not a good idea. But to explain why, he starts by teasing out three possible meanings of the word model. Thinking of a model law, what does the word model mean? Well, first of all, it may mean a representation of structure. Secondly, an object of idealized imitation. Or third, a type, template, or design. Rod then begins the paper with the following three questions that, he says, spring to mind whenever one enters into the terrain of law reform through model forms. These are the questions that spring to mind. One, should we understand model laws as we understand model airplanes? Second, should we understand them as we understand runway performers at a fashion show? Or three, should we understand them as we would understand an architect's or an engineer's template? Well, maybe these are the questions that obviously spring to his fertile mind. But more importantly, I dare you to read this first paragraph of this paper and then stop reading. You can't do it. It's impossible. You're hooked. In a subject that you never thought you'd read anything about, you're hooked and you read the whole thing. Kathy's talked about his paper on three models, harmonization, transplantation, and viral propagation. Again, only Rod. And how he takes us on a tour of the basics of the theory of harmony, transplantation in botany, viral propagation in genetics, and so on, and draws lessons for law reform from these other fields. The latter metaphor, viral propagation, I must confess I didn't understand when I first read it. When I read more and more about genetics from Rod in this paper, I finally got the idea. It's unplanned, unintentional migration of ideas from one jurisdiction to another, kind of like the JD, which has swallowed up so many common law schools in Canada, including my own, and replaced the LLB degree. But with Rod's paper, we get to compare the viral propagation myth for Article 9. We get to compare Article 9 to the common cold, to the AIDS virus. I think actually he thinks it's more like the AIDS virus than the common cold. Indeed, in Rod's treatment of viral propagation, one sort of gets the impression that the Article 9 norm entrepreneurs, as we must call them, they begin to look like the Donald Rumsfelds of global law reform, invading foreign jurisdictions at will, displaying great disinterest in and insensitivity to local conditions, and with no apparent or obvious exit strategy. Rod indeed defends the civil law tradition and its resistance to Article 9, and concludes, and it's an important conclusion, there are really no conceptual features of the civil law tradition preventing the enactment of a functionally integrated secured transaction regime that achieves the same goals as Article 9 and does so in an equally efficient manner. One gets the impression reading the paper that Rod's interest in civil law is not just a deep interest, it's an affection he has developed for the civil law tradition. Well, along the way, as you read these papers, you have the great fun of engaging with a brilliant and witty mind, and it is so pleasurable. Rod is willing to reconsider and abandon previously held views. It takes a large intellect to question what you've believed for some period of time, and Rod has a large intellect of this kind. At the beginning of these papers, we get the sense that Rod rather likes Article 9, and he indeed is impressed by it. He counts it as a brilliant achievement. But by the time we get to 2009, Rod reconsiders the validity of what he's come to call the Secured Transactions Theorem, or STT, which underlies the Article 9 approach. Again, the point is made colorfully by him. Adherents of the SST are characterized in religious terms for their faith in the untested hypotheses of the theorem and their failure to provide any justification for its distributed effects. As he states after reflecting on his work in the Ukraine and in Quebec, he says, I began to reconsider some canons of the STT faith. However, it was not until my seven-year experience with the Canadian delegation to UNCITRAL's working group that my tendency to heresy turned into full-blown apostasy. that's Rod. What lessons do I draw from Rod's work and from conversations with him over the years? I will have to be very brief. First of all, beware transplants. Secondly, beware untestable or untested theories. And three, do not ignore distributive justice in theorizing about private law. Now, I do not contend that Rod would necessarily agree with what I'm about to say, but each of those lessons, I think, can apply in the context of restitution. One Canadian scholar has taken the view that the decision of the Supreme Court of Canada in 1980 in Petkus and Becker has basically overruled all of the common law of restitution. Very challenging conclusion. Presumably the Supreme Court must have done this unintentionally because they didn't say that they were doing that and they probably didn't think they were doing that. But in any event, that decision has been viewed by this particular scholar and later decisions of the Supreme Court as having achieved a civilian rendition or replacement of the common law of restitution. Such scholars would, in my view, do well to read Rod's discussion of the difficulties inherent in transplantation, the transplantation of legal concepts from one system to another. Excuse me. My skepticism on this point was reinforced by my experience as a member of the Advisory Committee for the American Law Institute's Restatement Third of Restitution and Unjust Enrichment. The late and wonderful Professor Peter Schlechtreim of Freiburg was also a member of the Advisory Committee, and he would occasionally intervene in our discussions and say something like, "This reminds me of a very similar problem in German law." And that would be the last sentence of his that I understood on these occasions. He would then go on to explain in great detail the intersection of various concepts of German law that were, to me, quite mysterious and incomprehensible. Beware the untested theory. Peter Birks has offered a theory about the disgorgement half, one might say, of the law of restitution, the law relating to breach of fiduciary duty, breach of confidence, breach of contract, recovering the profits from these kinds of wrongful activity. Peter Birks urges that this body of doctrine is parasitic. It's the parasitic theory. That it's parasitic on other fields of law, tort, fiduciary obligation, and so on and so forth. Restitution in such a case is just a remedy. It has no independent theory of liability. It's secondary to other branches of the law. Well, this parasitic theory really has no practical consequence. It doesn't really explain the history of the doctrine. The history is inconsistent with it. It's very hard to draw a distinction between primary and secondary fields or branches of law. It doesn't really work when you try to apply it to the law of fiduciary obligation, for which restitution is the primary remedy historically and to this day. So the theory simply offers an untestable and simple assertion that the parasitic theory must be true. Well, with Rod's skepticism as my guide, I remain of the view that the parasitic theory is not a theory in any meaningful sense. And I hope Rod shares my apostasy on the point. Finally, the thought that distributive justice should come to mind when we're thinking about private law theory. As is well known, one prominent scholar has attempted to explain virtually all of the law of torts on the basis of the concept of corrective justice. He's recently decided to try and explain the law of restitution on the same basis. And again, I think we do well to take a lesson from Rod's work and ask whether or not distributive justice should play a role in thinking about private law theory as well. The central illustration of the law of restitution, or the easiest illustration of the law of restitution, is the recovery of a mistaken payment. I pay money to the wrong person, can I get it back? I pay a debt twice, the second time by mistake, can I recover that money? And the answer is yes. Historically, for centuries, recovery has been allowed in such cases. And one might say, and this particular scholar does say, this is obviously an illustration of corrective justice. The defendant's in pocket, I'm out of pocket, I should get it back. It seems fair. Well, if you think about it more deeply, why do we allow recovery of mistaken payments? What is the instinct that leads us to want to allow recovery in such a case? It seems to me that the law abhors the accidental loss of wealth. Finders, keepers, losers, weepers never had much appeal, even in the schoolyard. We all think you ought to be able to get it back. One possible explanation for this is that we actually abhor the accidental loss of wealth for the same reason that we favor its acquisition. That is to say, for the reasons that support the institution of private property. That institution cannot be justified on the basis of corrective justice. And if this is correct, even in this paradigm case of what might be an illustration of corrective justice, it may be that distributive justice plays some role in explaining why. And when we do the rod thing of trying to think about the foundational ideas that support recovery, it may be relevant. Well, I would like to conclude by saying that Rod is the inspiration for the work that I do. It wouldn't be quite right. I fall so far short of his achievements. It's really more a matter of humiliation than inspiration, I have to say. But I'll keep trying, Rod. And as I do, I'll think of you.
Thank you very much, John. I might add, note that Rod ends that story of the viral propagation theory of norm transmission with the optimistic note that it's possible the target may end up reinfecting the host and produce a mutation, in this case, a mutation of Article 9. David Lametti, my colleague here at McGill, we'll now address Rod's ideas on relational theories of property and how they relate to distributive justice. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Kathy. It's wonderful to be here. I'm here because we thought there might be a technical problem with the Ralph Simmons video, and therefore Richard Yanda asked me yesterday to step in. And then feeling so badly that the video worked, he asked me to stay. I take that to mean, thank you, Richard, I take that to mean I can say whatever I want, and I will seize the opportunity to talk about Rod's contributions on property at a level of understanding. I don't want to say concept, because Rod wouldn't use the word concept, before moving to questions of application. And I think you'll see that his relational theory of property is crucial towards his view of distributive justice, as well as towards applications in secured lending, in Aboriginal property, and in other areas. But I do have to start with an apology. A number of years ago, when I was a young colleague, Rod was nudging me towards secured transactions as a potential area of teaching and study. I have to admit, I resisted Rod, and I'm sorry about that. I just had too many balls in the air with property and IP and all the rest of it, so I'm sorry I couldn't join. We hired Kathy afterwards, and then we were fine. Let me start with one of the articles that is listed in your readings. It's the article called Rabbits, Ravens, and Snakes that Rod co-wrote with Tom McMorrow. However much human beings conceive their relationships with others in terms of spiritual interaction, these relationships are also mediated through material things. Basic conceptions of property, its forms, its objects, its uses, and its relationship to persons are the tools we use to shape this mediation. Inevitably, of course, relationships framed through what we call property are less intense than those framed by effect. So Rod's come to the conclusion that property is relational. In its most basic form, it is a series of relations mediated through material resources, and that these relations are important to ourselves, our sense of self, our conception of self-conception of self. They may not be intense at the outset as those relations based on spiritual interaction, but they nevertheless allow us to create and recognize relations to others through these objects. They could also mature into relationships of trust, and that's a theme that I'm going to come to in a moment. they're necessarily contextual. It's a ground-up theory, a context of relations, a congeries of relations, that's a Rod word, but also resources. And it echoes some of the themes that we saw yesterday of a focus on human agency, which Rod gets from Fuller, self-actualization through the use of the property form in a dialogue among the ruled or between the ruled and their rulers. So Fuller, Rundle. It's a fascinating journey to see how Rod gets to this point, and that's what I want to talk to you about today. And it's not an easy one. Other people have come to the conclusion of relational property. Jennifer Nadelsky through feminist legal theory. I've tried to do it through top-down legal theory. Admittedly, I think Rod's work is a corrective of that for very good reason. Rod's was through civil law constructs and the critique of civil law constructs in the context of the recodification of the civil code. It's a critical point in a number of articles that Rod picks up, the context and the history and the dynamic of the review and reform of the Civil Code of Quebec. And the relational theory comes out of that. I'm going to point you, I have to do this, I'm sorry, to three articles that are not listed in your readings, and I'll take this as a right, as having been added at the last minute. The first is Reconceiving the Symbols of Property, Universalities, Interests, and Other Heresies, that word again, from the 1994 McGill Law Journal. And a number of my old civil law property students are cringing right now because I forced them to read it. Rod deconstructs in this article the basic notions of civil property, patrimony, and real rights, taking on these symbolic, even iconic parts of Quebec property law, and suggesting that the substance doesn't live up to the symbol, that there's a bit of masquerading going on, and moves towards a more, I'll say, pluralistic, interest-oriented theory, I suppose I have to use the word, of property. And the method's important. There's careful attention to context in that article, to law reform, to legal interpretation, and to legal practice, and to legal epistemology. The last section, Reconciling the Word and the Deed, is majestic. Rod wouldn't use that word, majestic, but I will. It's majestic, and I really commend that to you. The second and third articles are more recent, and they both appear in collections. The first in called Relational Ownership, which I think is a critical article in understanding the underpinnings of Rod's theory of property. It's in a volume that celebrates the 30th anniversary of the center, which is now the Centre Crépeau, and the volume's entitled Cross-Examining Private Law. And I think it's the most cogent statement of relational property, period. And in this case, it's done in civil law terms. And again, it's spurred by the process of codification and understanding the history and the process of the codification of the recodification of civil law in Quebec, resulting in the Civil Code of Quebec. There's a deconstruction of ownership in this article. I don't know if Hoy is here, but there is another Rod list. There's Hoy. There is another Rod list in here. It's a great list. The ways in which ownership is limited, both externally and internally. Absolutely fantastic. And a suggestion that we ought to understand, again with careful attention to sources, property in terms of the idea of trust or fiduciary obligations. Absolute ownership, according to Rod, becomes possible only as an entropic condition. Where relations and resources are not all that valuable, can we have absolute ownership? Indeed, where they are important, all sorts of limitations and obligations will attach to ownership. And he identifies here a move which is critical, I think, to understanding it all. Ownership he highlights a nexus of commitment. Ownership is best conceived as the locus for a panoply of interpersonal relationships held together by a fiduciary commitment. It's that fiduciary commitment, I think, that is critical because it no longer simply underlies property relations and it brings in notions of stewardship and fiduciary obligations, true, But it also begins to underlie private law relations generally. Back to property for a moment. Property becomes important not because of exclusionary powers, but because of the kinds of relations that property makes possible, ownership makes possible. So it's a positive point forward. It's a building point, this relational idea of property. It's not simply a wall. Right? Finally, an article, finalement, un article que Rod avait écrit avec Jean-Fred Ménard. Jean-Fred, mes excuses, il faut que ce soit Jean-Fred parce que c'est Rod. Donc, ça ne peut pas être Jean-Frédéric. Qui s'intitule « Credo credere crediti creditum », essai de phénoménologie, je peux pas le prononcer en anglais non plus, donc c'est pas grave, des sûretés réelles. Il y a une section au début qui s'appelle la croyance avant la créance. Trois pages très importantes à comprendre l'œuvre de Rod. Ici, les obligations, et c'est lié au point que je viens de identifier dans l'autre article, c'est-à-dire les obligations font partie, elles aussi, de ce grand nœud qui était lié par les obligations fiduciaires. Permettez-moi de vous lire, parce que je crois que c'est très important. Le droit privé est le résultat de la médiation symbolique des interactions humaines à travers un cadre de règles, de principes et de concepts. Nos aspirations et notre conduite se rejoignent ainsi dans nos efforts pour imaginer notre vie future de concert avec les autres. Par le droit, nous tournons notre être vers le monde et sommes en mesure de donner corps à nos interactions avec les autres. Un rapport de solidarité peut naître directement entre deux personnes dignes de considération morale. Ainsi de suite. Et finalement, et l'État, lui aussi, les reconnaît, ces relations, et redistribue les biens et la richesse pour favoriser les solidarités sociales. Et donc, on a fait le saut entre la propriété conçue comme des relations en ajoutant des obligations fiduciaires jusqu'à la justice distributive. Et c'est effectivement, c'est le fait qu'on a, qu'on peut participer dans le droit privé, qu'on est capable, qu'on entreprend aussi les obligations de traiter les autres en même façon. And hence the link to justice. The nexus of obligation and property through a real right immediately implies the existence of others and is not limited to situations where a debtor is in default. Likewise, the idea of a common pledge of creditors is present from the moment of having a relationship. The simple fact of having a patrimony instantiates multiple relationships, and relationships instantiate distributive justice. So it's a very positive theory. We talked about this yesterday. It's magical realism? Not at all. This is possible. It's plausible. It's plural. It's prosaic and poetic. It is what it is, and it also is what ought to be. And hence, that other trope of positivism falls by the wayside. It explains a number of things in real security. It explains where Rod is pushing with respect to Aboriginal conceptions of property. And all of that is important. I think it's supremely important to my work. If I could shift to the personal just to conclude. First met Rod in his dean's speech in 1985 when I sat where you're sitting as a student and drank the McGill Kool-Aid, as has been stated. I was a student in Rod's foundations class and another class taught with Justice Rosalie Abella. I was his research assistant. But I got to know him best, I think, as LSA president in a year when I spent one time a week in his office, talking about stuff other than what we normally talked about in professional terms. Rod became one of my mentors and a colleague and a friend, and the dialogue on property that we have established continues to this day, and I thank you. If you could permit me just 30 more seconds. I teach property as well as IP, and Rod has taught me to look at the everyday. In Rod's day-to-day life as a father, Aiden skateboarded and occasionally ran afoul of formal norms. In my experience as a parent, it's the ever-pervasive internet and understanding how my children interact through that medium has brought in formal and informal norms, learning about rights, obligations, fairness, trust, creativity, learning, and sharing. And when you put all that together, my son perhaps may run afoul of copyright norms in terms of what he downloads from the internet. But I don't always think, and I have written this, I don't always think that that is wrong. In fact, I think there are times when creating and sharing and learning are more important than perhaps the absolute ownership rights of copyright holders. We would be far better off, far worse off, I agree with my son, if property norms had been used to shut down things like rap music, which I think is quite good in some places. And the behavior might even be virtuous, but virtue is a theme to which we will return to this afternoon. Thank you, Rod.
And our final formal panelist, Angela Swan, who will present a portrait of the artist as a young man.
I'm very glad to be here to honor Rod. I taught at McGill for, I think it was about 6 or 7 years, and I have to say that the Peel Street Hill is as steep and icy as it always was. I first want to mention the joys of teaching. As a teacher, I have two particular joys. One is the joy of realizing after every class that I know more than I knew when I started that class, whether it's how to perhaps say something differently, get a response from a student, or something like that. And then the second joy, of course, is that your students, particularly law students, will join you in the profession. And, of course, Rod is my graduate student. I was his thesis supervisor. And the joy that I have in seeing, in learning from him, I can't possibly say I taught him. I mean, we had fantastic discussions every week for the best part of a year. It started almost exactly 40 years, I think it was 40 years ago this fall, I think, because I have Rod's thesis here, dated 1975. It's called, and this is a buzzword in the 1970s, A Prolegomena to a Theory of Legal Relevance. Prolegomenas and prolegomenons were very popular in the 1970s. Its word has gone out of use, probably no harm, but maybe some scholars would like to revive it, you know, just give it another workout just to keep it going. Rod was the perfect graduate student. We'd have these extraordinary discussions every week. He worked extraordinarily hard. He claimed, I think, that he had discovered every single one of Lon Fuller's publications. I know that somebody some years later said that he discovered another one, another one that Rod hadn't got, but I've forgotten what that one was. But I want to just mention, well, first of all, I mean, with a graduate student, as I said, you learn so much from them. But I want to mention one thing which has not been mentioned so far in these couple of days, and that's this. We invited Rod and Chilio for dinner, and they invited us back to their apartment, which I think was on St. Joseph Street between Bay and Young. We had a lovely dinner, but Rod said something about Shelley then which has stuck with me now for, I guess, 39 years. Rod describes Shelley as a non-unidirectional woman. I didn't take it then as in the Stephen Leacock sense of riding madly off in all directions, but it said something important to me, which is that he had huge admiration for her, and that he admired her and her width, her breadth of interests. And I think, I don't know them well enough, but I think we have to acknowledge the contribution that Shelley must have made over the years to Rod. It must have been something wonderful and special. But I always remember that phrase. I don't know whether Rod can remember it or Shelley remembers it, but it was a lovely word, lovely phrase to describe somebody whom he admired. Rod's thesis principally is on Lon Fuller. I can't remember. Maybe it's discussed in the book that was launched last night, but I think it was my idea to Rod that he look at Lon Fuller. I think Rod was going to be looking at other philosophers. H.L.A. Hart had just been quite the thing at that time. In fact, I took a seminar at Oxford from H.L.A. Hart and rapidly came to believe that it didn't work. I discovered Fuller and I found that it did work and introduced Rod to Fuller. And I think the consequences are obvious. My own work, it's one of these things that one has as one develops one's own ideas, that you can't separate your own ideas from those that may have contributed to them. I say repeatedly in my contract writings that I can't remember which of the ideas that, say, Barry Reiter and I had, where idea came from whom. It's an idea that's there. And with Fuller, me, it's an idea that's just there, and I have incorporated those ideas into my own teaching, into my own writing. But I want to make some observations about Fuller. And one of the ones, this bears principally on a lot of Rod's scholarship, it's been my experience that the legal philosophers that I've found the most value from have been those who combined interest in philosophy with a practical concern for making the law work. Fuller was a contract scholar. Some of his writings in contracts, like Fuller and Perdue on contract damages and so on, are still cited by first-year law students, or cited to first-year law students. And I think that it's the what I call sometimes the discipline of the concrete case that informs legal philosophy. I taught with a philosopher friend of mine a course on legal philosophy at U of T, and we dealt with the Antigone. We had a bunch of philosophy graduate students in the course, and we gave them the oath that the Ontario judge swears when he or she becomes a judge, and we said, okay, you try, Antigone. What do you do? And it's the discipline of the concrete case. You can't just escape by into some kind of, I would say, philosophical dead end, but into some philosophical analysis which does not focus on how do you deal with the concrete case. And so I'm very glad that I, both from yesterday and today, are coming across repeated references to Fuller's work. I think that my impression had been, and I'm out of academic kind of, journals and things, that Fuller had been forgotten. But I hope he hasn't been, because there's a lot there to be learned. But I said the particular value of Fuller, at least to me in my career, has been helping me sort out narrow problems of contracts. And by the way, just as an aside, my own view of contracts is that first year should be 75% contracts, and the rest doesn't matter. I think John might agree with me, I don't know. John's another student of mine, by the way, so I've got... John is my first LLB student to become a dean, and Rod is my first LLM student to become a dean. I won't say a great deal more. I won't go through the papers that the others have talked about. They are an extraordinary example of scholarship. I learned a great deal. I was impressed by the vividness of the writing and the images. I was oppressed at times by the prevalence of acronyms. Acronyms kind of, I started to glaze over with acronyms, and some of them, I must say, were rather populated with acronyms. But I will just, as an introduction to what they say, I'm going to read you two extracts from the conclusion of Rod's thesis. So Kathy said, it prefigures the man. He says, in the first place, Fuller, by attempting to draw out the implications of viewing law as the enterprise of subjecting human conduct to the governance of rules, and those who know Fuller know it's the enterprise that's important, commits himself to examining the explicit and implicit elements of this endeavor. Such a task leads him to the conclusion that there are many differing forms of social order which conventionally are included within the realm of law. It's footnote 655. And then the second, slightly longer passage is this. Remember, his thesis was on the prolegomena to a theory of legal relevance. Applied to the problems of legal relevance, this thesis immediately shows a different orientation than legal positivism. The question of the elaboration and application of rules can be dissected and subjected to evaluation. The formal aspects of law are seen not as being characteristic of law, but in terms of facilities which they provide for human aspiration. Why are some rules more determinant than others? Due to factors such as lack of enforcement, ambiguity, misinterpretation, etc., becomes a central issue. Again, the question of justice, rather than being considered a meta-legal problem, is shown to pervade all aspects of law. Legal ideas are studied not as values imposed by external ethics, but as criteria which result from the needs and functions of the law in all its various forms. Finally, the problem of social control and coercion, which constantly lurked in the background of positivist theories, is digested whole by Fuller. The authority of law is seen to derive not from its sanction, but from its integrity. So I think we see that developed in Rod, and my final point is that I'm amazed and full of admiration that somebody 40 years ago can say this and can live his life, academic life, in that way. Thank you. Oh, by the way. One more thing to do. I'm going to give this to Daniel Boyer as a gift to the McGill Library.
Thank you very much, Angela. As in previous panel sessions, we have a number of interveners who have been asked or who have requested to take 2 minutes to offer their remarks on their relationship with Rod's work and with him. And I'm going to call on you in rather random order. Perhaps the random list that it ended up with Rich Cohen followed by Steve Weiss is appropriate since these are Rod's colleagues at UNCITRAL. So Richard, please. Yeah, I know. I should say that overall we're aiming to finish rather earlier than the program planned. We'd like to finish by 10 minutes before 11, so we'll all try to keep our remarks as short as possible. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you, Catherine. Good morning, everyone. My name is Richard Cohn. I'm a Chicago lawyer, and now, because of Rod's inspiration, a lecturer in law at the University of Chicago Law School. And I'm also the acting president of the Chicago chapter of the Rod McDonald Fan Club. And I say acting president because my wife, Joan, who is with me today, is unfortunately contesting my election. She claims that she won, but I won't burden you with Chicago or marital politics. I had the privilege of working with Rod for over 12 years on the expert groups and working groups for various UNCITRAL projects. That in itself was a truly wonderful experience, but in 2007, after we had finished 7 years of work on the UNCITRAL legislative guide on secure transactions, an amazing thing happened to me. Spiros Bezinas, the person in the UNCITRAL secretariat who headed up that project, had the novel idea of throwing Rod and me together, a scholar and a practicing lawyer, to give the legislative guide a good going over before publication. So I had the incredible opportunity to work closely with Rod for about a year with many long phone calls and meetings, painstakingly going through each of the guide's 554 and a half pages. It was truly a transforming experience for me, and I learned a lot about Rod in the process. For example, I got to the point where I could tell instantly when he completely disagreed with the point I was making. He would become very quiet, and he would do this sort of Jimmy Stewart sort of thing, and I knew he was trying to figure out how to tell me that I didn't know what the hell I was talking about without hurting my feelings. But I didn't care. I was having a great time. It was a highlight of my professional career and inspired me in many ways, not the least of which was my decision to begin teaching as an adjunct at the University of Chicago. Secure transactions reform is a high-stakes game, with one of its goals being to make low-cost financing available to small businesses in emerging markets where obtaining credit is currently beyond their dreams. When it works, low-cost credit can create jobs, raise standards of living, promote stability, even help reduce social injustice. And when the commerce generated by secure transactions reform spills over into other countries, when commerce among ordinary business people in different nations takes root and then becomes regularized through everyday transactions and interactions, the results can be more profound, generating understanding and trust and economic interdependence. In this way, secured transactions reform can facilitate the realization of human aspirations and at the same time promote the greater good. It is, in other words, a perfect field for Rod, and it will come as no surprise to you that his influence in this field has been extraordinary. For me, his work, including the lessons in the texts that we're considering today, have their greatest expression in Rod's actions at the UNCITRAL expert and working group meetings, in the way he has applied his incredible knowledge and practical wisdoms infused with his impeccable values to the issues at hand. As Professor Glenn noted yesterday, Rod has this uncanny ability to unpack the issues and to find out what is really lurking in the problem. Often when we reached an impasse in our deliberations, it was Rod who came to the rescue, providing a well-reasoned and pragmatic solution that carried the day. Rod, I think the lesson that has had the strongest impact on me is your belief that although legislation can indeed affect the way people behave by solving some problems, it won't work if it tries to solve all of the problems. You said that the law needs to establish a framework, and you've got to make sure that you get the framework right so that you could obtain commitment from people and so that they can work out the solutions to all of the problems. In terms of future work, we've now begun a new project at UNCITRAL, the development of a model law on secured transactions based on the principles of our legislative guide on secured transactions. Rod, I'm sorry you haven't been able to work on that project. You are sorely missed by everyone. I know your reservations about model laws, and we've heard a bit about that today, but I can tell you that the lessons that you've taught us, including the lesson about getting the framework right, are ever present in the UNCITRAL meeting rooms, and I am certain that these lessons will continue to inform our work. Rod, I am indebted to you. Thank you so very much.
I'm Steve Wise, also a lawyer in private practice from Los Angeles, and I'm one of the authors of the Wicked Article 9. And as I've sat here yesterday and today, I do wish I had studied harder in my French classes in the mid-1960s, it comes back a little bit. So what I would like to do is give an example from the Uncitral process where I met Rod about a dozen years ago, and Rod was so obviously understood the policies of secured transactions and all the mechanics, I just assumed that that was his primary professional exercise, not knowing it was a sideline. But he had mastered it like everything else he masters. But there's an example of how Rod took all of the approaches we've been talking about the last 2 days, fairness, justice, no borders, universality, things like that, and applied it in a very specific way. As Richard just mentioned, we came to a very tough point midway through the process on a sort of a civil law versus common law issue in secured transactions. And the Germans were on one side and the common law people were on the other side. And we argued. And then Rod, using all of these techniques, sort of figured, what did people really care about? What really divided us? Did anything really divide us? Sort of figuring out that the end results were really the same under each approach. Came up with this elegant solution of using civil law words to get to the common law result. And the civil law lawyers thought they won because all the jargon was civil law, and the common law lawyers thought we won because you got to the result that we were advocating for. Although listening today, particularly to what Kathy said, I wonder whether he tricked the common law lawyers. But in any event, we got to an answer that everybody was happy with, so it all worked sort of well. One other sort of anecdote that I think is emblematic of Rod, which is not taking oneself too seriously as one does these things. And during the breaks at the Uncitral meetings, which are never called breaks, they're always called a discussion session. You're not allowed to take a break. You have to work during the break. Rod and I and one of the other folks would talk baseball. And Rod, like everything else, knows absolutely every statistic possible about baseball. And at the beginning of the season, about this time of year, Rod and his other fellow, Neil, and I would make predictions as to who would win each league and each division and stuff like that. And we, of course, established an elaborate scoring system to determine who was right and who was wrong. If you pick somebody for second but they finished third, did you get a half a point or something like that? And then the fun part of it was we never settled up at the end of the season. It was all in the process of sort of setting this up that was a lot of fun for us. So Rod's been just an amazing inspiration for the working group and for me as we sit there in these meetings where, unfortunately, Rod can't be there. And if we hit an impasse, we say to ourselves, what would Rod do? You know, how can we figure this out? In my personal life, I do a lot of teaching for practicing lawyers, an occasional guest lecture at some of the law schools in California, Stanford, UCLA. And what I try to do, emulating Rod, is to not walk in and I get introduced as the guy you hate because I wrote Article 9 and it's some secured transactions class and they hate it because it's hard, they think. But to give them the big picture, to tell them what we were trying to do, what the goals are, what the social policies are, sort of thinking Rod in my head. And as somebody said yesterday, Rod inspires all of us to sort of up our game and really try to get this right. And then finally, I love the references to magical realism because my favorite author on earth is Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And the concept of taking magical realism from literature and culture and moving it into the law is really magnificent and sort of brings it all together for me. So, Rod, merci beaucoup.
Okay, we've still got five or six formal interventions, so I'm going to could we
yes.
move up the base? Terry Halliday.
I'm Terry Halliday, a sociologist of law at the Center on Law and Globalization at the American Bar Foundation, with an affiliation at the Australian National University, and I'm so grateful to be here to celebrate Rod's distinguished work. I've been pondering for a very long time this question, what makes a great global legislator? I've been pondering this question because I've been studying and writing about the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law, and Rod has had an outsized influence on this book manuscript. So there's a long answer, and it's turgid and prosaic. But there's also a short answer, and that is Rod MacDonald. One, having observed Rod and talked to him at great length about his role at UNCITRAL, one can speak of his authority, of his persuasiveness, of his innovation, of his charm, indeed of his sartorial splendor. But here again, Rod placed an outsized imprint on Canada's impact on global lawmaking, and it's a most impressive achievement. But let me just turn for a moment to Rod, the global portraitist, because Rod is currently working on a paper still warm from his desk and a collaboration that Sally Mary and I and others have been working on around an idea of transnational legal orders. And my co-coordinator, Greg Schaefer, and I approached Rod a few years ago with a modest challenge. Rod, would you write a chapter that surveys for decades the global emergence of secured transactions across the entire world in less than 50 pages? And by the way, it should not be addressed to technical lawyers, but to mere social scientists, political scientists and sociologists. And of course, a few months later, Rod delivers this in 47 pages. And it is emblematic of the craft of Rod's work. It is magisterial. It is imaginative. It is evocative. It is contrarian. And not least, it's consequential. It's not only a description of what happened across the world over the last generation, but Rod here again is anticipating, indeed making, global public policy. I'd love to say something about Rod, the research subject, because I've been talking to him at great length over the last decade about his participation and his observations about his participation, but time cuts off those observations. So I would just like to say, Rod, on behalf of all of us in the Transnational Legal Order Collaboration, all of us who write on global lawmaking, we express to you our great appreciation and our great admiration. We are honored to have been counted among your academic confreres.
Michel Deschamps.
I am Michel Deschamps, a lawyer with McCarthy Dietrich in Montreal, and I also teach banking law. I met Rod and Shelley in the early 80s. Rod was the supervisor of my sister Marie's master thesis, and the subject of the thesis had been recommended to my sister by Rod, and was another example of his wide interest. Undivided ownership in intangibles. So over time, we met more and more often. We became close friends, and from year 2000, Rod, Catherine Walsh, and I have been working together as Canadian delegates to UNCITRAL. What characterizes Rod the most is his approach not only to legal matters, but to society issues in general. The conventional view is not his cup of tea, as has been pointed out by the panelists. Among the many things I learned from Rod is the fact that day-to-day life is the source of most legal rules. And Rod's best demonstration of this truth is his book, Lessons of Everyday Law, which is a recommended reading. And in my view, his best work. If you are still unclear about the meaning of the term distributive justice, you'll learn that in his book. For instance, you'll learn that you'll learn the meaning of distributive justice in reading a story on how to split a chocolate bunny. I conclude with a brief anecdote. We were at customs. Then there is the usual question. Anything to declare? Rod's response was, yes, my brain. Thank you.
There's so much to say and so little time left to say it, if to hope to even make the original end hour. Lionel?
Thank you, Lionel Smith. Rod may not remember the first time we met. It was during my first teaching position at the University of Alberta when he gave a talk about access to justice, and that was when I first engaged with not only his brilliant ideas but his extraordinary stage presence that was so well described yesterday by Kim Brooks. It was in 2000 that I joined this faculty and joined a large group of people who have the benefit of Rod's collegiality and of the wise counsel which he shares so generously. But it was between those two times during the 1990s that I first started to engage deeply with Rod's scholarship in fundamental private law. Most people in the room know that this year is the 20th anniversary of the coming into force of the Civil Code of Quebec. And even after all those years, there are a number of difficulties and paradoxes with which people are struggling relating to some very fundamental notions like personality, patrimony, ownership, titularity, and so on. The same year that the Civil Code of Quebec came into force saw the publication of a text that David has already mentioned, Reconceiving the Symbols of Property, which shows that at the very moment of the coming into force of the new code, Rod was not only fully aware of these paradoxes and difficulties represented by its text, but was at the forefront of proposing innovative new ways of understanding them. And it is perhaps a measure of the importance of that text 20 years after its publication that at one and the same time it is used still in teaching first-year property law while people like me are still mining the text for ideas and insights in relation to our own research. The other contribution that I wanted to mention is the great book, Quebec Civil Law, which was published 1 year earlier in 1993 under the general editorship of Rod and of John Brierley. This book is unique. There is nothing like it, either in English or in French. And anyone who wants to understand Quebec's legal history, Quebec's legal culture, Quebec's civil law, the way in which Quebec civil law understands itself should start, even 21 years after its publication, should start with this book. And I'll close by saying I'm delighted to know that Rod, along with Dean Jutras, as general editors, have undertaken, with the participation of many members of the faculty, have undertaken the production of a new edition of that really important book. Thank you.
Okay, if the interventions are 30 seconds, we can make the 11 o'clock deadline. But I'm not optimistic. Bill Flanagan, please.
Yes, Bill Flanagan, the Dean of Law at Queens, and I'll keep my remarks very brief, Kathy. First, how I met Rod. Rod gave me my first job as a legal academic back in 1989, and it was a thrilling experience to work as a young academic with Rod. And Allison Harveson Young and I were both young pups at the time, and we would often compare stories of Rod charging into our office a million of miles an hour like a tsunami with intellectually challenging ideas. It was both thrilling and a little bit terrifying, and it was just a wonderful mentor, really, to all of us as young academics. My legal career, my life took me elsewhere, and so I had an opportunity to watch the developments of McGill Law School over the years and Rod's scholarship, and I just wanted to mention his contribution to critical legal pluralism, as the panelists have discussed today, is extraordinary, not only in secured transactions, but in other areas of law. I also wanted to mention his contribution to McGill as a law school and its transformation over the last 20 years. When I was here as a young academic, I would not have characterized it as a powerhouse in critical legal pluralism that it, of course, has become today, very much to the credit of the law school. And I just can't imagine that transformation happening without the intellectual leadership of Rod. And indeed, he has continued to exercise such a intellectual centrifugal force. We have lost the occasional faculty member to McGill. I won't mention any names, but I just wanted to mention how much I thought Rod had contributed to that intellectual energy of the law, faculty. Thank you.
Thank you. Isabelle Deschamps, a second Deschamps.
Oui, alors bonjour à tous. Merci de me donner l'opportunité de parler pendant une minute. Alors, donc moi je suis doctorante ici à la faculté de McGill de droit, et vous ne serez pas surpris d'apprendre que je suis dirigée dans ma thèse par Rod, que j'ai rencontré par l'entremise de mon père. Alors, mes recherches portent sur l'impact du droit commercial sur l'opération des petites entreprises par les femmes en Afrique de l'Ouest, en Afrique centrale. Et puis, de façon plus générale, je m'intéresse à la manière dont le droit commercial peut être réformé pour améliorer la situation socio-économique des femmes en Afrique. Alors, l'influence que les enseignements de Rod ont eu et continuent à avoir sur mon travail se situe tant au niveau de la méthodologie que du fond de ma thèse, si tant est que l'on puisse séparer ces deux éléments. Alors, du point de vue méthodologique, je continue à travailler sur une approche que j'ai nommée le pluralisme juridique clinique, et dont le point de départ a été l'un des textes qui vient d'être mentionné, qu'on a amplement discuté hier. What is critical legal pluralism? Et donc, dans cet article, Rod et Martha Marie Kleinhaus expliquent, entre autres, que a critical legal pluralism calls on the role of citizen subjects in generating normativity and presumes that subjects control law as much as law controls subjects within its normative sphere. Donc, fortement inspirée par ces propositions et par les discussions que j'ai eues avec Rod sur ce qu'elles impliquent, j'ai tenté au cours de missions de recherche empirique en Afrique d'observer et de découvrir le droit vivant qui régit les petits commerces africains et d'identifier les normes que suivent et que créent les femmes commerçantes dans les pays que j'ai visités. Ce faisant, mon objectif et de déterminer comment le droit formel actuellement en vigueur dans ces pays obstrue, concurrence ou complète le droit non officiel, et comment le régime de droit des affaires dans la région peut être réformé de façon à ce que les pratiques commerciales des micro-entreprises soient reconnues et leurs normes rendues plus efficaces, justes et efficientes. Et donc, au niveau du fond de ma thèse, c'est en réponse à la question « comment réformer » que les textes qui ont été assignés au panel d'aujourd'hui enrichissent ma réflexion. en particulier donc l'article sur Article 9, Norm Entrepreneurship, en raison notamment, à mon avis, des principes et propositions qui sont intemporelles et quasi universelles qui s'y trouvent concernant la méthodologie à suivre pour réformer le droit de façon à respecter le contexte local tout en intégrant les règles et les principes internationaux en matière ici de sûreté. Donc, merci beaucoup, Rod.
Merci, Isabelle. Et finalement, David Stevens. And I might add that Ralph is still here.
So we're at our limits, and so I'll be very short and cut my...
Thanks.
I really enjoyed all the talks. Don's quote from Rod's thesis, the second quote, I thought was particularly compelling and really does sum up Rod's work for me, and that is the inspiration. So I'm a practitioner now. I was a colleague of Rod's at McGill and grew up as a scholar under Rod's leadership. And I remember reading the articles last night on the train coming here, Présomption de Hypothèque. Rod was dean and trying to run a law school and save the civil code from itself at the same time. His scholarship is simply brilliant. And the remarks that I had, and I won't go over them, was I was thinking through his writing and thinking through, well, that's where I learned actually to write, how to think about writing, how to think about research, and how to think about scholarship. And in some I had six axioms, but I'll reduce it. Always pay attention to fairness and distributive justice, especially if you're doing just private law. You can't ignore the bigger picture. Always pay attention to what's going on really in society, in culture. Law is a cultural achievement, and to do it well, we have to pay attention to what's going on in society and in culture. I had some other ones, but we're at our end, and he was a wonderful mentor and leader, and I think, as I said, that quote really does sum up the right approach.
Thank you, David. That's a fine, high note to end things on.